From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Connecticut's Supreme Court says Sandy Hook parents can sue Remington for the way the company markets their AR-15-style weapon. Plus, another Democrat joins the race for president.
The only way for us to live up to the promise of America is to give it our all and to give it for all of us.
Also today, families react to the largest college admission scandal in U.S. history.
If I had $10 million right now and I could buy a ticket so that my child would be able to access an amazing education that was going to unlock an incredible future, that's what I'd spend my money on, absolutely.
And
from the Pacific Coast to the North Sea, things began to happen on the now quiescent front of women's rights.
Looking back on the fight for women's suffrage 100 years later. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. And we begin today in Connecticut with a narrow ruling from the state's Supreme Court in a lawsuit challenging federally granted immunity to gun manufacturers. In a 4-3 decision, the court ruled to reinstate a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer Remington, filed by families of victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. If Remington loses the suit, it would be a landmark ruling that would deal a huge blow to the gun industry. Here's lawyer for the families Josh Koskoff at a press conference just this afternoon in Bridgeport.
Nobody is above the law. Even a gun company that is powerful, even a gun industry that is politically connected, even in the face of some statutory protections, no industry is fully above the law.
And joining us now from Westport, Connecticut, is New England News Collaborative reporter Cassandra Bassler. She's a senior editor at NPR station WSHU. Cassandra, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, if you can remind everybody, what is this case all about?
Sure. What this case focused on was nine families of victims who were in the Sandy Hook school shooting back in 2012 filed a lawsuit, as well as one survivor, saying that the way that this Remington Arms Company manufactured the rifle that was used in the shooting and the way that they marketed that gun was in violation of consumer protection law. They basically said that this company manufactured a gun that was originally designed to be used as a military-style weapon, and their argument was that they shouldn't be selling that kind of weapon to members of the public. And basically the court said, let's let the Connecticut courts settle that, so the lawsuit's moving forward.
Okay, so the lawsuit will move forward. Can you tell us a little bit about the implications of that decision?
Sure. It's the furthest lawsuit with a gun manufacturer it's the furthest a lawsuit has ever moved forward with a gun manufacturer since Congress passed a law in 2005 that basically broadly protects gun makers from being sued. So people across the country have been looking at this lawsuit saying this could be a landmark case. Notably absent from the conversation today is Remington's lawyers. They haven't really made any comment, but a lot of people expect that they will take this to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so you're not hearing from Remington. Are you hearing from the families or their lawyers?
Yes, the family's lawyers have spoken out. They just had a press conference today. And they're, of course, very happy because all they've really wanted is to have their day in court. They wanted to have these questions about how these guns were marketed to somebody like the shooter in the Sandy Hook shooting. And the only way they can really see a way to do that is to request documents that can be presented as evidence in court. And this is the first step to getting those internal marketing documents and things that will sort of show where the thinking is in marketing AR-15-style rifles to the public.
Yeah, I think happy, obviously, is a relative term when you're talking about a tragedy like this. We actually have some sound of Ian Hockley. He's the father of one of the victims, Dylan, who was age 6 in 2012. Here's Ian speaking at that Bridgeport press conference from earlier.
I can't say I'm excited by this ruling. I wish it was never here. But what we've said from the outset is, all we want is our day in court for the law to be upheld and for a jury to decide our case.
All right. So to that point, their day in court, this case has been kind of snaking its way through the legal system for years, started in 2014. Can you tell us what's going to happen next in this case?
Sure. Well, I haven't actually heard from both sides saying where it's going to proceed, but the expectation is that this will land before a jury. The plaintiffs will be able to ask for documents from Remington, like I mentioned, talking about sort of how they were thinking about marketing and advertising these guns. The way this court case came about was one of the mothers of the victims was sort of trying to make sense of how this tragedy had happened, and she realized that there are advertisements that Remington put out saying things like, get your man card reissued, and advertising their guns, and they really thought that it's sort of targeting this demographic of people trying to motivate themselves to make violent acts against other people. And so this is really just another way of making sense of, you know, was that the intention behind the marketing tactic?
Yeah, and obviously a lot further to go on this case. That's New England News Collaborative's Cassandra Bassler, reporter and senior editor at the NPR station WSHU in Westport, Connecticut. Cassandra, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
For more on what this case means in the legal world, we turn now to Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So let's start with your initial reaction to this ruling. Are you surprised?
Well, I'm very surprised. That in 2005, when Congress passed a law that was essentially immunizing gun manufacturers from a whole host of civil actions in the various states. I mean, literally, the statute begins with the Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms. There were very narrow exclusions. And to my knowledge, no other court has found a civil action that met that exclusion. There was very, very narrow exclusions. And the one exclusion was that when the manufacturer or seller of a product knowingly violated a state or a federal statute with respect to the marketing of the product and the violation caused the harm, then it can be the basis for a suit. But this exception, what is very, very narrow, intentionally very narrowly drawn, and to my knowledge has never succeeded in allowing a lawsuit to proceed.
So obviously that makes a tough climb then for the families. Connecticut does have a state law, the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. What's the legal argument that they're trying to make with using state law?
Well, it's an extraordinary argument, and it's to some degree limited to this particular, to the gun that was used in the Sandy Hook shooting, which is to say a gun of such considerable lethality, a gun that is so clearly intended for military use, was marketed then for civilian use. But there is simply no appropriate civilian use for anything that is as lethal as this weapon is. And so it's essentially, you know, it's an unfair marketing approach, which is extraordinary. They couldn't claim that the gun was wrongly in the hands of the shooter because the gun had been purchased by his mother, as you may recall. And so all of the usual debates about, you know, did the gun get in the hands of a mentally disabled person or something like that don't apply here. So this is really more broadly that they are marketing an extraordinarily lethal weapon for civilian use when there really is no appropriate civilian use whatsoever for the gun.
So that's the that's meaning the state law that they're trying to use there. There's also an exception. You mentioned there are a few exceptions to the 2005 federal law protecting gun manufacturers. Negligent entrustment. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that
factors? Well, negligent entrustment is where is what I was just describing, which is to say that someone had negligently put this gun in the hands of a third party when they shouldn't have. And the difficulty here is on the facts of this case. Adam Lanza's mother, Nancy Lanza, is dead, and no one knows the circumstances of the under which he got his hands on it. So it really was a difficult claim to make. So the unfair marketing issue is a much more interesting one, and that potentially opens the door to other similar lawsuits across the country. Massachusetts has a consumer protection statute. The Attorney General, for example, could consider, there are lots of pitfalls on this road, but could consider bringing such an action as well. Again, this is a uniquely lethal weapon that is described as so lethal that the speed of the bullet creates its own wounds, even if it doesn't land appropriately in a, you know, a delicate area. The shockwave from the bullet can be lethal. The amount of gun, the amount of bullets that it produces is obviously lethal. And what they're saying is there's a mismatch between the purpose of this weapon, what it was intended to be used for, and civilian marketing.
So the lawsuit will now proceed based on this ruling. That will include a discovery process, which could reveal some internal communications at Remington. What sort of legal implications could that have?
Well, consider the tobacco litigation, for example. I mean, the tobacco litigation opened the door to troves of documents that enabled people to look at how much the tobacco manufacturers knew and when they knew it about the danger of the substance. Nobody's ever been able to do that now because of the extraordinary breadth of the federal law and the limited nature of the exception. There's no question, however, that before you get to discovery or the rest of this lawsuit, the defendants are going to take this to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court it was going to have squarely before it what's the breadth of the immunity for gun manufacturers on the one hand, and what's the meaning of this exception.
Yeah, so
it will be a very, very controversial decision.
Yeah, I'm hoping you can just, one final question, give us a little bit of an idea of the scope of this case here. On the one hand, a lawyer for the gun manufacturer says there's no case law on advertising being declared a cause of death, talked about how misleading advertising has usually been what's been gone after under these rules in the past, not targeting specific populations. The NRA is saying that this could eliminate legal protections for gun companies. What's this mean for us in Massachusetts, the country at large, as we watch this case unfold?
I know.
I'm sorry.
So first it's going to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to say, did the Connecticut court interpret a federal statute appropriately? Is it appropriate for this to go forward? Then if it goes forward in Connecticut, there are still many pitfalls, which is they have to show a knowing violation. They have to show that the violation was a proximate cause of the harm. There are lots of steps here that they would have to ultimately prove in order to succeed. Around the country, different states have different language in their consumer protection laws. Massachusetts has a very broad one, largely empowers the attorney general to go after this. The product was defective. The car didn't drive. It was deceptive because it marketed to civilians when it was a military weapon.
Yeah.
So every state will have to look at its own consumer protection laws and see whether it fits within these exceptions as well. That door had never been opened before.
Long way to go on the story, obviously. I should add, we reached out to the Attorney General's office, did not hear back in time for air. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, now senior lecturer at Harvard Law, WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thank you so much, as always, for the time.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
A crowded 2020 field gets even more crowded today. Beto O'Rourke, the former Texas congressman whose national profile skyrocketed after his 2018 Senate race loss, says he was born to be in the race for president.
This moment of peril produces perhaps the greatest moment of promise for this country and for everyone inside of it.
And joining me now for a check-in on 2020 is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Chris.
So I want to get your reaction to Beto O'Rourke's announcement in just a minute, but as we know here in New England, better than most, all paths to the White House lead through New Hampshire.
Right.
That's where Elizabeth Warren will be headed tomorrow. You were just up there this weekend. Bernie Sanders had his first rally in the state. You were there when Warren announced earlier. You say these two candidates are headed for a clash in New Hampshire. Can you talk about what you saw while you were up there?
Yeah, a clash. I mean, two candidates they both come from neighboring states. Warren, of course, from Massachusetts. Sanders, of course, from Vermont. They have home field advantage in a way in the all-important first-in-the-nation primary. Both represent the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which means they're fighting for a lot of the same voters. So that's why I was talking about a possible clash up there. And voters regard them in many ways as political twins. They're both talking a lot about inequality, how Washington is rigged at the expense of working Americans. They're both pushing for big changes. Warren for what she calls systemic change and Sanders for what he calls a political revolution. So, Chris, let's listen to a bit of their message, starting with Bernie Sanders this past weekend in Concord.
This campaign is going to transform our country and finally, finally create an economy and a government which works for all of us, not just the 1%.
An America that works only for the wealthy and the well-connected, that's corruption, plain and simple, and we need to call it out for what it is.
So that was Elizabeth Warren at her first New Hampshire presidential campaign rally this past January.
Yeah, I'm noticing a bit of a similar theme there in their messages. We know these are two pretty progressive candidates. How are voters thinking about their two candidates?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough choice for progressives, especially when you consider there are lots of other candidates as well talking about a lot of the same issues. So for voters, Sanders is probably better known. That has a lot to do with the fact that in 2016, of course, he won the primary in New Hampshire. He thumped Hillary Clinton by 22 points on his road to winning some 22 national caucuses and primaries. So he's arguably, at this point, in this very early stage, the front runner. He's also raised a lot of money, $10 million in the first 2 days, attracted more than a million volunteers online. And so he's counting on people like this. Here's Susan Dodge of Sanbornton, New Hampshire. She voted for him in 2016 and says she's sticking with him in 2020.
Bernie really worries about the little guy. That's his major concern. He sticks by his message, always has and always will.
So that's interesting. I'm sure he's got some loyalty from voters there. Are there any that you talked to that have decided to switch over to Warren's camp?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's important to remember, as I stressed a moment ago, this is early times. And it's important to remember that this primary is almost a year away. It's a lifetime in politics. So there's no guarantee that Sanders can count on that legion of supporters that backed him last time. For example, here's Ray Lanier of Concord. He voted for Sanders in 2016, but says now he's got two big concerns.
Age and who's going to win against Trump, I think. Those are the two issues. I'm 78, 79 next month, so I certainly understand what age does to you. I think that's a big asset or not.
You know. Or not. I see. All right. So Lanier says he's moving toward Warren.
Yeah, very much so.
And how do they differ?
Style. As far as policies, I don't see much difference between them in reality.
So they do have different styles. They do also have some policy differences. I'm curious, how are you seeing this race? What's going to tip the scales? Is it style? Is it policy difference?
It's interesting. It's hard to say, but let me talk about the style because that gets to who these two people are. You know, Sanders comes from this long tradition of political activism. When you go to these rallies, Chris, you know, he favors big rallies, long policy speeches. He rarely mentions his own biography. Warren, by contrast, she's a former professor. She favors smaller events where she can go one-on-one with voters. She offers personal stories. And this is a key part of her message. She uses her biography to explain what ails America today. For example, how her mother could use a minimum wage job to hold the family together when her dad got sick and lost his job. How she was able to go to a commuter college for $50 a semester and go on to become a Harvard professor. So she's committed to a set of policies, the wealth tax, for example, on the super wealthy, that she sees as leveling the playing field for working Americans.
All right, so there is some difference in how they're delivering the message. Is there any policy difference here? Are you seeing any daylight between the platforms?
It's not really. The bigger difference between them has to do with their fundamental beliefs and how they describe them. So, you know, Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist, he talks about a political revolution. And he uses very blunt language to challenge some of these basic institutions in the capitalist system, the insurance and pharmaceutical industries, the military-industrial complex, and Wall Street, where Sanders says he wants to do things like break up the big banks. Now, Warren, too, wants to break up the big banks and has recently proposed breaking up the big tech companies.
Right.
But she's not a democratic socialist. She describes herself as a capitalist. She was once a registered Republican. She says she believes in markets, that markets work when they have rules and when they have a cop on the beat enforcing those rules. And she can point to her work setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as an example of what she means by having a cop enforcing the rules. So at least in terms of her approach, she's able to sort of embrace the current system in a way that Sanders doesn't, as long as it can be policed in a way that makes sense.
Great. Anthony, stay with us. I want to bring in another voice here, WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who joins us now from Washington, D.C. Kimberly, I'd love to hear your thoughts on all this, but we do have some breaking news that I want to start with this last hour. The Senate has officially voted to overturn President Trump's border emergency declaration. The House had passed a similar rejection last month. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it was expected. The White House tried really hard to lobby enough Republicans on the Senate side to try to defeat this, but that effort was not quite enough. You had roughly a dozen Republicans joining with the Democrats to essentially nullify this emergency declaration that would divert funding from other things, from the Department of Defense and other programs, to construction of the border wall. The White House is expected to veto it. There weren't quite enough Republicans that could withstand to overcome that veto in the Senate. They would have needed about 20 to do that. So the White House is expected to reject this, but this is still a really stinging defeat for the White House and President Trump and his signature issue, which is the wall.
Yeah. Okay, so back to what you just heard Anthony Brooks talking about. Sanders and Warren are competing in New Hampshire. They're obviously two among many that is the Democratic 2020 field. There are some folks that have kind of a bigger national profile, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker maybe. How much do you think Warren and Sanders' closeness to New Hampshire will help them in the primary?
You know, I think it depends on the voter, of course. You know, talking to people in New Hampshire, they don't necessarily think that it is a hometown advantage to be from New England. New Hampshire understands that the folks there understand that they are an early primary state, that they're important, and that they play a big role in vetting who the nominee will be. And I agree with Anthony. What I'm hearing is the number one issue is, can the person beat Donald Trump? They are focused on who can beat Donald Trump. And I think that's going to be the measure. Someone shows that they have that fight in them and that they can take him on in a general election and win. That gets them into the door. And then beyond that, they have to describe just how they'll do that and what their policies are.
Okay, so speaking of someone that they're maybe raising a question of whether or not it can win, let's turn to Beto O'Rourke. He has now officially jumped in the race. Anyone surprised? What do you make of his entrance?
Yeah, it's interesting to me, this idea that a three-term congressman with a sparse legislative record, whose biggest claim to fame is that he lost a Senate race, can be considered a credible candidate. On the other hand, he generated lots of excitement. He raised a ton of money, and he came close to winning, the Senate race in a very red state. And but it will be interesting to see, because he could be that sort of centrist, moderate centrist voice that could galvanize moderate Democrats and independents in the heartland. But I'm curious to see if he can translate the talents that allowed him to come so close to winning the Senate race in Texas to the national political stage. It'll be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you raise, because a lot of the analysis has been that this is a party that's moving to the left. O'Rourke has said he won't call himself a progressive. He's been criticized for some kind of more centrist policies and tendencies. Kimberly, how do you think his candidacy will play in New Hampshire and continuing forward?
I think we'll have to see. I mean, in many ways, his slate is a blank one that hasn't really been painted yet. While you have others who are coming in with labels, you know, Democratic Socialist or Progressive, he is really keeping that open. He is capitalizing on the energy that he generated from his message, that aspirational message that reminds a lot of people of Barack Obama, and that he was able to get as much support as he did in a red state. is not only getting the attention of a lot of Democrats, but also Republicans. You know, one conservative group, Club for Growth, has already run ads against him. Republicans are clearly, they clearly see him as a threat. And I think that's one thing, as we talked about, the ability to beat Donald Trump, the ability to show that he could be a threat to Republicans is something that a lot of Democratic voters are going to be impressed by.
All right. So this is an ever-growing field. I want to ask you, we know Warren is headed to New Hampshire this week. Congressman Seth Moulton says he will be traveling to the Granite State sometime in the next few days, followed by a visit to South Carolina. Moulton hasn't officially jumped into this race. Anthony, is he in, and how could that complicate things for Warren and Sanders in New Hampshire?
I don't know if he's in. I know that he's been giving this serious thought for a long time. He went out to Iowa way back when for the Polk County Chicken Fry, which is about one of the earliest sort of Democratic organizing events in Iowa that exists. He's been a little coy about it, but we know he's giving it serious thought. He hopes he can occupy that sort of national security lane as a military veteran. So, yeah, he's going to New Hampshire. He appears to be moving closer to a decision. We'll just have to wait and see. I don't know if Kimberly's got some closer intelligence on this.
Moulton's potential entrance.
Yeah, well, I talked to him yesterday, and he continues to say that he is taking a very serious look at it. He sees his background as a veteran, as somebody who has gone out and recruited veterans to run for office and win and really generate excitement as part of a new generation, as he likes to talk about it. He sees himself having something to say, and he's going to make his pitch on Saturday in New Hampshire and then move on to South Carolina and back to Iowa.
Another story with a long way to go. That's WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for the time.
Always my pleasure, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, how parents are reacting to the alleged college admission scam. I'm Chris Sitterick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. We're continuing our conversation today about what officials are calling the largest college admission scam in history. Federal prosecutors allege a California businessman, William Rick Singer, helped parents lie, bribe, and cheat their kids' way into elite colleges. 50 people across the country have been charged in connection with the scheme. Yesterday, while talking about this on Radio Boston, we heard from one mother who said this news felt like a stab in the back.
It makes me feel pretty betrayed that there are two sets of rules here. As the mom on board handling homework night after night and packing backpacks and trying to send the message that if you work hard, good things will happen, it's really hard to hear that if you have the money, you can buy yourself in.
Carrie Rodriguez, founder and mom-in-chief for Massachusetts Parent United, is with us now. Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you are also a mom. You have three young kids. What was your reaction when you heard this news?
Well, my first instinct is kind of to think, you know, my three little boys are Latino, and they're prime candidates for the school-to-prison pipeline. So when I think about, you know, what would be the first thing I would do if I hit the Powerball tomorrow and got $10 million, I would immediately want to buy them the best possible education I could possibly get. So I could understand it.
Yeah. So you mentioned your kids are Latino. We spoke earlier with Dr. Angela Neal. She's a psychologist, author of Soothe Your Nerves, The Black Woman's Guide to Understanding and Overcoming Anxiety, Panic, and Fear. And she said basically that this kind of news, college admissions process being even more rigged than we maybe previously thought, can really trigger some mental health issues for kids. I want to play a little bit of what she said.
You're running the risk of people giving up, becoming hopeless, which is a symptom of depression. But I think if we're talking about mental health, then we're looking at depression and also some anxiety. Well, are they really going to look at my application fairly? What does this mean for me? Is there really a space for me at this college?
So I think that's a really powerful theme that we're seeing kind of again and again from different communities who have already felt like the system is stacked against them. What's your reaction hearing that?
Well, unfortunately, it sounds very familiar. I mean, from where I sit, the system is already stacked against me. It's already stacked against my kids. This is kind of reinforcing of things that we already know. It's hard to hear, you know, that it's so blatant, but you know, in my personal case, you know, I consider myself to be a survivor of the public education system. I was expelled from a public school. I had to scratch and claw my way to get to college. And all I want for my children, and the reason I fight so hard, is because I see the inequities in our public school systems, and I want to fight to change it. So, you know, I know what they're in for, and I can see the difficulties right now. So it's almost just a reaffirmation of things that we already know as a community and the way the deck is already stacked against us.
So I know you said that if you hit the lottery and you had this kind of disposable money that you would maybe consider something like this. I'm curious how you think about from the perspective, we have a statement that just came out today. Jack Buckingham, whose mother was one of the parents charged in this scandal, who said, "I know there are millions of kids out there, both wealthy and less fortunate, who work their butt off to have a shot at the college of their dreams. I'm upset that I was unknowingly involved in a large scheme that helps give kids who may not work as hard as others an advantage over those who truly deserve those spots." Do you think that what the parents were doing here was a disservice to these kids, basically undermining this lesson that if you work hard, it will help you achieve things?
Well, of course, because this is the promise that we give to all of our kids. I mean, I sit down with my kids and say, listen, if you try hard and you do your best, you're going to get someplace in life. And I believe in you, and I'm going to fight as hard as we can to get you through what is an institutionally racist education system. But if you do your part, mommy's going to do her part, and we're going to get you through. So the problem is that, you know, we know that talent is equitably distributed, but opportunity is not. And so I don't have the opportunity to just buy that opportunity for my kids. I don't have those kind of resources. So me promising them that if they do their best, they're going to be able to you know, achieve these amazing goals of getting into the college of their dreams. We know that that's just not the case because the system is rigged against kids like mine. And when it comes down to it, I mean, this is again, not something that's surprising. And when we take a look at what's happening in Boston right now, the valedictorians report, the brand new Boston Foundation report that came out last week about college completion, I mean, we have to understand that children of color and low-income kids are starting out not at the same starting line as every other white kid, and certainly not at the same starting line as every affluent kid. You know, we're starting from 10 miles behind. We've got to run that 10 miles till we get to that starting point so that we can start to talk about, you know, how we can access opportunity. The entire system has to be disrupted. It's just, it's not equitable, and it's not fair.
Yeah, one of the things we've been talking about is, while this is obviously kind of an over-the-top example and illegal, obviously, that there's this kind of whole spectrum of advantages that are available to some. Do you see a difference in your mind in what these parents did and someone who says, who say pledges $2 million to a school to build a new building to maybe help grease the wheels a little bit? Do you see a difference there, or is it all kind of all on the same line?
Well, even that is an extreme example.
Sure.
Okay, because every single day in Massachusetts, we have wealthy parents that are able to provide supports for their kids. They can get them music lessons and sports coaching and tutoring and all of these additional supports outside of the traditional school structure that parents like me, we just can't afford. So that, again, that class issue, those race issues always come into play. And those are things that we overlook. At the same time, we also indict parents of color in particular who have done things like, you know, tried to sneak their kids into a school where they, or a community that they didn't live in. I mean, there are cases where parents of color have gone to jail and paid enormous fines for being, quote unquote, caught, you know, sneaking their kid into a public education system because they don't, quote unquote, deserve to be there. I mean, like, it's so ludicrous the way that the system is set up, and parents are really trying to do the best they can, especially parents of color, sometimes low-income parents working two or three jobs just trying to survive,
trying to
provide for their kids.
I think you're bringing up some interesting points and talking about some of the more common examples of what some people might call gaming the system. A lot of families will move to a town based on the school district. Do you think that that's a level of gaming the system?
Of course, because that's access to choice. I mean, we have this conversation about whether or not parents should have choice in education. We've been having it for years now, and how, you know, that economic mobility, that upward mobility that parents that have been able to achieve a certain level of economic success, that you have options. If you're not happy with the Boston Public Schools and you have the ability to move to Newton, you're still going to public schools. I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, that's a game changer for kids.
Yeah.
Now, do you think an average parent living in Roxbury and Mattapan who is earning $30,000 a year has that kind of option if they're not happy with the school they've been assigned to in Boston Public Schools? Of course they don't. So, again, we set parents and kids up in a system that is rigged against them. And we limit the options that parents have to provide that kind of economic and educational foundation that could break a cycle of poverty and stop all this.
So I'm curious kind of how you reconcile, because you say yourself, if you had the means to do some of these things, you would do them. How do you reconcile parents that are just trying to do what's best for their kid with this kind of systemic inequity, and how do we fix it, basically?
Now, I of course say that, you know, I would buy that kind of education for my child tongue in cheek, you know. Because
yeah, but let's say you could move to Newton or a district that has a school with more funds and more resources. Is that something you would do? And would you begrudge parents who do something like that?
Well, would I do that? If I thought that I could take my children out of a system that was, you know, not going to perform for them, of course I would. Because I want what's best for my kids. But
right.
At the same time, we are trying to change a 120-year-old system that is based in systemic racism, institutional racism. Like, that's going to take some time to change. So immediately, out of selfishness for my own kids, are you kidding me? Of course I was. If somebody handed me a check for $1 million and said, Carrie, you can pay for private education for your children, I'd be crazy not to do that. Because the consequences for kids like mine, for Latino children, for Black children, are poverty, incarceration, and death if we do not improve the public education system.
Yeah.
And that is what we have to be focused on.
A lot to unpack here in the story still. That's Carrie Rodriguez, founder and mom-in-chief for Massachusetts Parents United. Carrie, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, looking back at the fight for women's suffrage 100 years later. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. With a record number of women in Congress and a record number of women running for president, some are calling this a new era of women in politics. But of course, it wasn't all that long ago that women didn't even have the right to vote.
From the Pacific Coast to the North Sea, things began to happen on the now quiescent front of women's rights. By 1915, Finland, Norway, Iceland, and Denmark had joined New Zealand and Australia in extending the franchise to women. In the autumn of 1916 in Britain, reform of the franchise laws was begun. By now, there was no doubt about women's right to the ballot.
Conspicuously absent from that list, of course, is the United States. The 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, wasn't adopted until 1920. Author and journalist Elaine Weiss has a new book on the fight for women's suffrage called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, and she joins me in studio now. Elaine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Chris.
So the 19th Amendment's passed and ratified in the summer of 1920, but this is a story that starts decades before that. You focus at the final push in the Tennessee state legislature. Why did you decide to make that the focus?
Well, this is the last battle for the last state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to make it enter the Constitution, which would give the vote to every woman in every election in every state for the first time. And this is 35 states had ratified. They need 36, or three quarters of the 48 states in the Union. And this climactic battle really crystallizes all the themes, all the arguments, all the nastiness of the seven decades of fighting for the vote that came before. So it was a great front story for me to focus on, and then allowed me to pull the camera back and show the full movement and how it arrived in Tennessee.
Yeah, it's always important to consider historical context. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on at the time? World War I had just ended a couple of years earlier. There's a presidential election on the horizon. How did all those things kind of play into this?
Sure, they all played in. Sometimes we think of women's suffrage, if we think of it at all, because we often don't know very much about it, that it just was a little bubble floating in the historical horizon. It just happened. Men saw the light. They gave women the vote. And the tenacity of the women who had to fight for this for seven decades in America is really quite remarkable. So it comes down to this final push in the summer of 1920. There is a presidential election, as you mentioned. It's pivotal because America has just come out of World War I. It's trying to decide its role in the world, whether it's going to be isolationist or it's going to be a leader of the free world. There's great anxiety about immigration. There's anxiety about labor. There are many labor strikes, a sense of inequality in our economic system.
This is sounding very familiar.
Yes, it is. It's really strikingly familiar. There's a lot of racial tension. So it's a time that's very, very fraught. And to have this big change, the largest expansion of our democracy in history, come about right now in 1920 makes it even more unpredictable.
I think one of the things I was struck by as I was going through the book is kind of the power and influence of female leaders in the anti-suffrage movement. I mean, that's kind of, on its face, you just kind of say, wait, what? Can you talk a little bit about their role?
Well, I was truly shocked when, in my research, I came upon some of the strongest opposition to giving women the vote came from other women. And, of course, this is something for us to think about now. Women are not monolithic in their thinking, in their politics, or in their cultural thoughts about how society should be structured. And women's suffrage was going to change women's role in society. And so some of these women saw it as a real threat to the American family, to the American moral system. That's how they phrased it. They thought there were cartoons that showed America when feminized, and it warned of a downfall of the American family. Men were going to be emasculated. Women were going to wear the pants if they could have the right to vote. So these women, for a whole galaxy of reasons, were very, very opposed. And they organized, and they were strong, and they had great influence. Of course, they were in the minority, but they were a strong minority. And you could say, how could they work against what we would consider women's best interests?
Yeah, but self-interest.
Exactly. But that does happen, as we know from modern history.
Yeah. I think a factor that gets overlooked sometimes when we're talking about the suffrage movement is racism. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can give us a little context for how that played in.
Yeah, racism is threaded through the movement. I should say race is threaded through the movement, because the women's rights movement actually comes out of the abolition movement in the middle of the 19th century. And so the women we think of as suffrage foremothers are really abolition workers at the beginning. They're working with Frederick Douglass, who also supports women's rights as well as rights for enslaved black people. So these two movements actually are siblings for a long, long time. Race enters into it when, after the Civil War, the women are told, no, the nation cannot take two big reforms at once. You're going to have to wait. The woman's hour will have to wait. And so there's this tension of who gets the vote and who doesn't get the vote. And this is something we should think about today, because there are still citizens who are being denied or the vote being made more difficult for them. And what happens, what I saw also, of course, there's racism among some women in the movement. It's a racist society, especially 19th and early 20th century. But also in Nashville, when my story takes place, there's a huge push of racist rhetoric used against the suffragists, saying, you know, the 19th Amendment is going to allow black women to vote, and we can't allow that.
It's a fascinating dichotomy, because you have these women who are fighting for progress on the one hand, but kind of bowing to the racism of the times on the other. How did you think about that as you're writing these characters? Is this a hero? Is this how did you kind of grapple with that?
I did have to grapple with it. You want your characters, especially such idealistic, hardworking, believing in America and democracy kind of characters, to be perfect, and they're not. But they are also, I think, when we see some of the racist rhetoric that they employ in order to get the amendment passed, they tell the Southern senators and legislators, don't worry, there's more white women than black women. It won't rock the boat. They use that kind of argument as a political expediency. And is that something we should cheer? No. But we should understand why they were doing it, too. But they're also, again, it's the anti-suffrage movement that really uses racism to get its point across.
But it is prevalent on both sides. I have to ask you kind of a tough question. You know, there's a Machiavellian element here. Did the end justify the means in your mind?
Well, the 19th Amendment would, I think, not have passed in the states for ratification, nor in the Congress, if they had not salved some of the fears of racist Southern congressmen and Southern legislators. So whether this small step of getting women the vote, hopefully, the 19th Amendment is race blind. It does say all women would get the vote.
Right.
It was how it was implemented in the Southern states, especially in the North. Black women could vote in the West. In the Southern states, it's the Jim Crow laws and it's the black codes, which prevent women from voting. And Congress did not enforce, it's given powers of enforcement, did not enforce the 19th Amendment. So who's to blame for really the sad outcome of black women getting the vote legally with the 19th Amendment, but not being able to exercise it?
All right, so we've spoiled the ending a little bit, but I'm going to ask you to read a passage. It's describing Carrie Catt as she's waiting to hear the result of the vote in Nashville.
Right. So Carrie Catt is the leader of the mainstream women's suffrage organization, the National American Women's Suffrage. Alice Paul is head of the more radical wing. And Carrie Catt has spent 6 weeks in Nashville, miserable 6 weeks. She's being held basically under house arrest in the Hermitage Hotel, which overlooks the State House, because her presence would be so inflammatory as a Northern suffragist that they just keep her hidden. And she runs the campaign from her hotel room. So this is the morning of the vote. It's August 18th, 1920. The vote is about to take place in the House of the legislature, and Carrie is sitting by her window. Carrie Catt again kept vigil as the open window of her room, straining to hear the periodic bursts of cheering that spilled down from Capitol Hill. The imposing visage of the State House filled Catt's window frame just as it dominated the skyline of the city. In that building, at that moment, her cause and the future of American women was being debated and decided by men. She could only watch. Catt was amused to find that the Tennessee suffragists had gotten hold of a replica of the Liberty Bell, that famously cracked symbol of American independence, and installed it in the House chamber this morning, ready to be rung the moment the vote was to ratify was won, when it was won, if it was won. For years, in so many of her speeches, Catt had spoken of a moment heralding women's political freedom. The bell of liberty would surely, inevitably ring, she'd say, because there was nothing so powerful, so irresistible as an idea whose time had come. But sometimes, like this morning, she had to wonder. Some men in that statehouse across the way were undoubtedly making the same arguments against women's suffrage that Susan Anthony had heard. And some women were still frightened or deluded enough to be applauding them. The vote was likely to be excruciatingly close. Even at this late date, there was no firm consensus, no overwhelming mandate for giving women the vote or permitting them full citizenship. She tried not to wonder whether America was ready for the Liberty Bell.
It's staggering to kind of hear that and think about here we are 100 years later. That, as we said, was a decades-long struggle. How are you reflecting on this movement and the progress we've made over a century?
Well, I wrote this book. I finished it just before the 2016 election. And I, in the time since, I didn't realize that there would be so many relevant issues. Everything from, these are citizens, these are ordinary women who organize themselves and take to the streets. They march, they picket, they protest. And then, of course, comes the Women's March of, again, ordinary women protesting government policies. And it really gave me a moment to wonder how history repeats itself. This is, again, a cry from American citizens saying our rights are not being protected, that we're not even considered full citizens. And here we are at a time when we're questioning rights of citizenship, voting rights, women's rights, press freedom, all these rights we've taken for granted, and suddenly they seem shakier and endangered again. So it meant a lot to me in the midterm elections when a few of my readers wrote to me and said, you know, I carried your book into the polling place with me for inspiration. We need this history now.
Well, that's Elaine Weiss. Her new book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. She'll be speaking at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7. Elaine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Withman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Sidorek. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait. Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.